Mini episode 879 of the FDH Lounge is brought to you by Sportsology, delivering unconventional columns and webcasts about sports, TV, music, movies, and more. Follow them on the web at sportsology.com.
The FDH Lounge. You want to schedule your life around it.
A long time ago, on a gloomy, wet Cleveland spring night, two men stand alone amidst the late night drizzle. Their voices echo across the vacant station parking lot as they debate the merits of the great American radio show that have been missing for far too long. On that night, an idea was born. That idea became the FDH Lounge. Welcome to the FDH Lounge.
Hello, everyone. Welcome to FDH Lounge mini episode number 879. We have a very special guest on with us here today. He was on with us back when we were doing the regular full-length episodes at the late lamented Sports Talk Network, actually in our last couple of months that we were over there. He was on with us for episode number 144 on April 19th, 2011. It was a great conversation with him then, and a pleasure to have him back on to talk about his new book. And a pleasure also to get to talk to somebody in the acting business, because it's been really great over the course of our 10, almost 11 years now with the great roster of guests that we've had on the program. A lot from the world of sports, a lot from the world of entertainment, some pro wrestlers that fall into a nice hybrid there. And but when you slice it down to actors, the roster that we've had on that, it's been deep in quality, if not quantity, with the folks that we've had on: Dan Loria, Dominic Chianese, couple appearances from Matthew Modine, and now the second appearance from Curtis Armstrong with his excellent new book, Revenge of the Nerd, or The Singular Adventures of the Man Who Would Be Booger. Curtis, it's a great book, and I'm so happy that you included us on your book tour. Thank you for coming back on today. How are you, sir?
Yeah, I'm doing very well, Rick. Thanks. It's nice to be back. That was longer ago than I had remembered, actually.
It was a true pleasure to have you on. Well, I'll tell you what. I referenced something during that conversation. You probably won't remember the particulars, but it came up in the last couple of days. I had your book. I've been taking it around. I've been showing it to some friends. I was at a family event the other day. I showed it to my cousin. First thing he said to me is, you know, I tend to think of him primarily from Moonlighting, because I loved Moonlighting so much. I said, I told him that in the interview 6 years ago. I asked him if anybody ever said that to him, and he said, not really. I mentioned that to one of our show contributors, Anthony Patrone, who said, funny thing is, I generally tend to think of him primarily from Better Off Dead, because that's one of my favorite movies ever. So it's a small sample size, Curtis, but you've actually got three people who primarily think of you as something other than Booger.
Right. Yeah, well, that's nice. I mean, the thing about it is, I don't have at all a problem with, you know, being associated with Booger, with Revenge of the Nerds. I mean, you know, I have always thought of it that the career that I've had over all these years, at least the film side of it, the TV side of it, is basically built on four jobs, which were Risky Business, Revenge of the Nerds, Better Off Dead, and Moonlighting. And everything that happened in movies and television after 1983 or 4 had to do with those jobs. And it's hard for me to really resent a character like Booger. It's something that at the time I thought I would probably hate, because it was a character which is very far from who I was and how I thought I would want to be remembered. But since then, I've realized that, you know, it was a good, solid piece of work, and it really does mean something to people. And it's hard to be resentful, you know, toward a character like that.
Absolutely. Very well said. And I definitely have some questions on that. I want to build towards that, because I want to do justice to the entirety of your book here and to all the different areas that you address, because I think it's important for people to understand how many different elements there are to this book and some of the things that you got into. And your experiences with growing up, I found that to be fascinating, both talking about what it was like as a young expatriate back in the 60s, but then also something that I had just seen a little bit myself, and you're talking about an era before when I had seen it, but you were talking about growing up in the Detroit area and being in one of the big three families there, having your family working for one of the big three companies and the sort of executive class in Detroit there. And that was something that I saw a little bit in the 90s, right before everything kind of hit the iceberg. I was at the time working for the Cleveland Athletic Club, and we had some events with the Detroit Athletic Club. So I had cause to be up there, and it was very eye-opening to me. And I think it will be eye-opening for people in the book to read about this, particularly when thinking of Detroit now. The large executive class that used to be there in that town, it was far and away anything beyond what we had seen in Cleveland in several decades. Once upon a time, we had that, and that had kind of faded away. So it's an interesting bygone era that in the last 20 years or so with the automotive industry has pretty much kind of gone by the boards. But the picture that you paint of that time and of a very different Detroit and pre-race riots and all of that, also post-race riots when you came back. But that time and place that you're talking about, I think, is going to be very interesting to people.
Well, I mean, it was in the 60s, it was obviously even, you know, very different from the 80s and 90s. In the 60s, there was the sense that even though there had been the riots and there were problems in the city all over the place, at the same time, there was a sense that the auto industry was something that was never changing. It was always going to be there. It was always going to have that influence. It was basically what was feeding an entire city. I mean, more than that. I mean, it fed the entire industrial Midwest in a lot of ways. And so with my family, my father, my grandfather, both being in the executive class at, my father was with Chrysler, my grandfather was with General Motors, was seeing things in that, you know, now I look back at it and it's sort of like frozen in amber, that sense of what that kind of white privilege was at the time, particularly in the Detroit area, but at the same time was, you know, my mother's side of the family, who were Italian immigrants and who suffered considerably from the kind of bigotry that was very common in Detroit at that time. And my grandfather had to work his way into, ultimately, a position as an executive in a bank. But it was not easy. And that pull and push between executive and blue collar, between WASP and Italian immigrant, was something that was always present in my life growing up.
Absolutely. And when talking about your family, what was kind of interesting to me is that there was something in there that sort of subverted expectations, I thought, a little bit when you're talking about the memoirs genre. For somebody that goes into the performing arts such as yourself, you were mentioning about, again, your parents' love of music. For your mom, you mentioned liking some theater. And a lot of times you read that, and then subsequently you end up reading a little bit later on in there. So they were very happy with my choice of career when I decided to go into it. So it was really interesting to me. Yeah, you get into that, but they didn't exactly, you know, pursue it to that degree of, we want you to go do this. So you really had to sort of go against the grain a little bit there.
Well, but I have to say, I don't know that I've ever met an actor in my life who told their parents they were going into acting, and the parents were excited about it.
That's true.
And that goes for people whose parents are actually in the business. I don't think that ever happens. I think there's a general knee-jerk response from parents when their children say they're going into the theater, which is, oh my God, don't do that. You know, you'll have nothing to fall back on. You know, it's very difficult business. You're, you know, out of work a lot. You'll have no insurance and blah, 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 all that. And so I definitely did get that response, but I don't think that's uncommon. And certainly my mother, although she did love music and she loved the theater and so on, it was very much, it was fine from distance. It wasn't something she wanted to see her son go into.
Well, you know what? That's a point very well taken. That the entertainment business, acting, that might be something where you don't tend to see that as much in terms of parents wanting that for their kids. But obviously, spoiler alert, everything turned out well in the end here. And what I wanted to ask about, you sort of hinted at this a little bit before when you were talking about the major cornerstones of your career, and this was a question I'd already intended to ask anyways, but in terms of looking at Risky Business, which you lay out in the book there, how instrumental that was, how important, obviously the first big break. In a sliding doors world where that doesn't happen and you end up looking for that first major role elsewhere, obviously not everything looks the same afterwards, but do you feel that it was absolutely critical to the amount of success that you would later get in terms of having that role? Do you get a sense that you might have been up for some of these other roles subsequently anyways because you were good at playing them? How vital was that, in other words, that you had gotten that role to really start kickstart things?
Well, it can't be overstated how important it was, because it wasn't just a first movie. It was a really good movie that was you know, well received by people. It was really more important almost within the industry than it was, like, for example, I don't know if it did that well critically. I don't know how much money it made at the box office or anything like that, but in the industry, people, writers and directors and DPs, people like that, directors of photography, they were the ones who tended to notice Risky Business because it was so beautifully made. And that was what wound up benefiting me, because the director of Revenge of the Nerds, Jeff Canoe, was a devoted fan of Risky Business. And Savage Steve Holland, who made Better Off Dead and One Crazy Summer and all the other things I've been involved with him, was the same way, another big Risky Business fan. And if you look at Better Off Dead, you'll see that in some ways there are a lot of sort of winks, a lot of parodies that touch on Risky Business, because he was also a big fan. And then when I read for Moonlighting, Glenn Gordon Caron, who was the creator of the show and the showrunner at the time, before he hired me, he wanted me because he was also a fan of Risky Business. But he then called the producer to find out what I was like to work with, because he didn't want someone who was difficult. But that means that, you know, that just that one period between Risky Business and Moonlighting, the most significant jobs I had in that decade were because of Risky Business. Absolutely, there, you know, and then, you know, they then lead to working in other jobs. So it was all very, very, those early movies were hugely important, but Risky Business absolutely at the top of the list.
And that's pretty much how I thought you would answer the question. Very, very interesting to hear you elaborate on that, though. That makes all the difference in the world to be able to hear the elaboration and how you saw the pieces fitting together. And something that I think also is out there that people should know about in terms of going out and reading this book is that you did a very good job of not just chronicling everything with your career, but of the people that you were around, and just sort of painting some pictures and giving some anecdotes there, whether it be John Cusack, Bronson Pinchot, whether it be Demi Moore, Bruce Willis. There were some interesting and I thought kind of funny little anecdotes from the Moonlighting set there. And I would say brutal honesty, but again, funny, not mean-spirited. Just a very sort of, I think, folksy kind of way of telling these stories and what it's like being around these people and all of the drama on the set of Moonlighting. I can't say enough about how great it was to be able to just sort of get your impressions of dealing with the other actors and actresses that you were around during this period of time, the ones that really came of age with you in the 1980s.
Well, it's a very different way to look at it now, because now we look at Tom Cruise or John Cusack or Bruce Willis, you know, people like that, you know, as these huge names and so forth. But that's not the way I approached it at the time. They were, you know, Tom had done a few movies, but he was 19, you know. John had done some movies, but he was younger as well. Bruce was around my age, but he was really just starting to break into TV. I mean, he none of these people were, you know, huge stars when I worked with them. They were just actors. You know, all of those people from that period. You know, it was. You know, the only time I remember working with anyone in the 80s who knocked me out because I was so impressed by who I was working with was Alan Arkin in a movie that nobody remembers called Bad Medicine. But Alan Arkin is one of those people, and Jason Robards later on in the 90s when I did Adventures of Huck Finn. You know, those were two actors who I worshipped. And so, you know, it was very exciting and somewhat intimidating to be working with people like that. But Bruce Willis was just a guy. I didn't know his name at all. You know, I talk about it in the book when I was writing down my notes when I got Risky Business, and I was writing down, you know, where it was going to be and for how long and who the director was and all of that stuff. I was writing it down, and they said, and the lead actor in it is Tom Cruise. And I remember writing down Crewes because I had absolutely, you know, obviously no idea who he was, and I couldn't imagine it being spelled any other way. So, you know, then years go by and we look back and we see these huge, larger-than-life actors, and you think, gosh, it must have been really exciting to work with them. It really was just working with people.
Well, see, that you just put another layer on what I just said there. That's very interesting because, again, you know, these formative years in terms of these actors and actresses really kind of breaking out and getting to the big time, and as you point out, in many cases, you know, whether it be Tom Cruise, Bruce Willis, you know, Bruce Willis before he was Bruce Willis, so to speak. And
exactly. That's the thing. I mean, I remember my first day on Moonlighting. What impressed me was Sybil Shepherd, not Bruce Willis.
Sure, because she was totally established.
I've seen Sybil Shepherd in the movies since 1971. So, you know, I was far more impressed with Sybil than I was with Bruce.
Absolutely, yes. She was big time coming in because of her long track record, and that's one of those things that really made for the very interesting offset chemistry, as it were, and I guess you'd say bad chemistry offset, as far as her dealing with this upstart star, Bruce Willis, who is now being regarded as being on her level, coming out of nowhere. And I can't say enough as well about all the great tales that you told about what it was like to be on the set of Moonlighting, sometimes just a fly on the wall as you're kind of painting the picture there. For people like me who were like obsessed with the show back in the day, I just thought it was just really, really great painting that you did there as far as talking about that. And as far as the show's as far as the show's place in TV history, I'm curious what you think about this because, you know, it's more so we think of it from the rock genre where the whole thing of like live fast, die young, leave a nice corpse. But we see that a lot of times with bands as well. And again, you indicated in the book, obviously, what a big Beatle fan you turned into in the 1960s, after not initially being one, as you pointed out, but becoming a big one there. And, you know, you look at the Beatles and what they did in the 70s individually, and you think, well, what could they have done, you know, if they stayed together longer? Did they have more stuff in them? And without directly comparing the Beatles to Moonlighting, this is one of these things where I want to know from somebody that was on the set, that was there, that was a vital part of this thing, had they been able to get the egos and everything like that and all of the offstage craziness under control, is this a thing that really could have gone on for a long time and become a dominant franchise on TV over a good period of time? Or was the instability that was a part of the element, part of the magic of it, that always ensured that it would be short-lived?
Well, I don't think that if you mean the instability specifically about Moonlighting...
Yes, just the offset tensions and everything like that, whether it be with the network,
well,
between
I mean,
the stars.
I don't think that the tensions were that much worse than they are than they have been on other shows. I think that they garnered more attention because of just the charisma of those two people. The way that they came off together on film was, you know, it was what made the show what it was. It was what made a star out of Bruce. It was what made Sybil's star continue in the ascendant, is the fact that they just, I mean, it was brilliant writing all across the board. They had the best writers in Hollywood. And but there was also that charisma without which, you know, the best writers in the world would be useless. But I think that what made the thing sort of explode is the fact that people were so obsessed with them and how they came off. But I've worked on many, many, many films and television shows where, you know, the tensions have been as bad or worse, but nobody really cares. It was specifically because of them. And, you know, I've seen behavior that, you know, was worse than theirs since. But, you know, no one would care.
Very interesting. So it's all about what flies under the radar and what doesn't. But it's very clear.
Here's another thing, though.
Uh-huh.
The thing about moonlighting, you know, in talking about that, as you pointed out in your questions about the early days and so on, it really was my intention to do a narrative, a nerd narrative, where, you know, it wasn't like I had not been a nerd before Revenge of the Nerds. I was born and raised a nerd. I may not have called myself that in the 60s, but I was. And so I think as a result of that, once we get into the films and the TV and we start dealing with figures who are very well known, that to some extent takes over the narrative, because everybody's interested in that aspect of it, and I can't blame them. But it was not my intention to just do like a tell-all book or
sure.
something, or you know, go after people for that reason. It wound up, you know, a lot of the focus tends to be on that because that's the instant connection that people have. And also, it was for me, when I started working on this, I didn't really have a book that I was sort of framing mine on. I'm a big reader, and I love reading books about film and music and so on. I didn't have one that I was using as an example or a template. But what I did know was one of my favorite actors had been Alec Guinness. And before Alec Guinness died, he had written his autobiography. And it was, you know, got quite a lot of attention at the time, more because Star Wars, I guess. But for me, I was excited because I had loved him in the Ealing comedies back in the 50s. Those were among my favorite movies. And I was so excited to hear him talk about that period, working with Herbert Lom and Robert Crichton and Peter Sellers and people like that. And I then, you know, I got the book on the first day it came out, and it turned out to be primarily about his conversion to Catholicism, which wasn't interesting to me at all, especially as someone who had been raised a Catholic. So the one thing that I, you know, when I started work on this book was, while I want to tell a nerd narrative that has to do with my life, I also am aware that people are not going to buy the book unless they get the behind-the-scenes stuff from the films. And so I didn't spare the stories for the whole.
Absolutely. I want to co-sign on what you just said there. The only example that I can think to use in the typical kind of odd style of this show going back over a period of time, we had a time several years ago when in back-to-back weeks we did book interviews when Bob Barker had his book coming out, Priceless Memories, and a woman named Missy Hyatt, a pro wrestling valet from back in the day, and she did a real tell-all, wrestlers she slept with, etc. So from one end of the spectrum to the other, Bob Barker's book, completely upright, didn't get into any of that stuff, whatever. Missy Hyatt's book, the other end of the spectrum, and I don't judge her for that. It was a great, entertaining read, let me tell you. But your book, let me just frame it this way for the listeners, far more Bob Barker than Missy Hyatt. It was classy. The stuff you got into was not in any way inappropriate, in my estimation. So I just want to make sure I'm clarifying that, as I also praise you for your candor in telling these stories.
Well, thank you.
In sort of building the whole thing here, the theme of the book, Revenge of the Nerd, it was interesting to me, again, we talked about this a little bit, as far as the reckoning of how you eventually sort of came to grips with this character and what it meant to you and how it helped to define your career. And the question I'd like to ask you about that is that we always hear it's sort of a negative slant put on these type of things here. The word in Hollywood, of course, always gets to be typecast, and that's basically taken as like a poisonous type word. Actors and actresses many times are fearful of being typecast. I tend, from the outside looking in, more so to think of it more broadly, sort of like a wheelhouse, that a defining role can help sort of define where you fit in, what your strengths are, things you bring to that. And an example that I would use, I'm a fan of Aaron Paul, and he did such a great job on Breaking Bad. I've been a big fan of the Hulu series The Path, and if you watch The Path, you can certainly see some of the Jesse character from Breaking Bad in there. It's not a lot of it, but you can see a little bit of it in there. And your roles, you talked about it before, as far as the overall sort of nerd catch-all kind of a thing here, there's some commonality to the roles that you are best known for over a period of time. So talk about that as far as, on the one sense, the negative sense that people are fearful in Hollywood of being typecast, but on the positive sense in terms of establishing your wheelhouse and where you best fit into the business.
Well, I think that when it comes to typecasting, it's an odd... I think there is a definition, I mean, a difference between being typecast and being defined.
Yes.
And I think that being defined, a defining role would be, in my case, would be something like Booker. It's the one that everyone knows, basically. But for me, as I was going through, as I was living through my career and continuing to live through it, I don't think I ever thought Booker hurt. I did play the role four times, but that was a choice that I made. But I don't think I ever felt that it had hurt me in any way. On the contrary, like I was saying earlier, it got me well known. It got my name better known. As the years and decades would go by, I would wind up getting jobs, all sorts of different kinds of jobs, from guys who were, you know, kids when the movie came out, and are now, you know, in the studios. So, and they, you know, would think, oh, I loved this character, I want to hire this guy. So it never felt like it was overwhelming me. It never felt like it got in the way of my doing other things. After Moonlighting ended, and I went on to do more stage stuff and more TV stuff and more film, none of it ever will probably, in the way that Nerds is, be as culturally resonant, you know. But then, you know, it was still going to be a few years before I would actually act in a movie that got an Academy Award, which was Ray. And then, you know, going on from there to doing, you know, a bunch of the features and television series that I've enjoyed so much since. All of that stuff is what I am looking through, not how everyone else looks at it. So when I am questioned about the typecasting thing, I have to say that it never, ever struck me as something that was a problem for me personally. I do know that there are actors who swear by typecasting, and they claim that it, you know, has destroyed movie careers. Basil Rathbone, one of my favorite actors from the Golden Age, you know, claimed to his death that he had been destroyed by typecasting. Maybe so, but it has never felt that way to me.
Well, very well said, and that's an excellent distinction that you make there. And when I was flipping through your book as you were talking there, I was trying to find the example in time, and I couldn't find it. But if I describe it generally, I think you'll know what I'm talking about. There is something there in the book where you referenced a conversation in subsequent years with another actor, and where you sounded a little bit at the time maybe sort of jaded where things were at. And it's sort of a renewed appreciation then for Booger and for what everything had meant to you. So talk about that, if you would, because that was
Kevin Corrigan.
That's right, that's right.
And I was doing a show that he was in, Logue, and we were just, he was younger, and we were talking, and it was a bad time. I mean, it was post-Moonlighting, I don't remember. It was probably in late 70s, I can't exactly recall. But it was just a bad time, And but Evan, of course, was looking at me as somebody who was working all the time and had done these roles that he'd loved when he was young and so forth. And you know, for him, he couldn't imagine that there would be anything wrong at all. And I was a little dismissive of what I was doing at that point. I didn't feel good about it. You know, I'd done a run of, you know, movies that I hadn't liked or hadn't done well, and, you know, this kind of thing. And that was when, after I had sort of gotten all that off my chest, Kevin said, "You do know you have a career that a lot of young actors would kill for, right?" And what was significant about him saying that was realizing that I had a career at all. Even at that point, late 90s, I never considered what I had done all of those years as a career. It was just something that I went from one to the next, to the next, to the next. I never thought about it as a career. He thought about it as a career, and that was a life-changing moment.
Interesting. Yeah, I'm glad I remember that part to have you say that there, because to hear it, to draw you out on that a little bit more, I think is valuable, and on how you can be sort of refreshed in your appreciation for some of the things that have happened. And again, a book with a lot of internal revelations as far as your thought process and going along and describing how you felt about things at various times as they were unfolding. A really, really excellent book, I feel. In terms of other things going on subsequently here, I have a very poor record of asking people about things from Wikipedia, because in almost every instance, it's been something that's been put on Wikipedia falsely, so we'll see if my losing streak ends. But I see that you were listed for the Barbie movie in 2018. is that accurate?
Yes, I know.
Okay.
It's really funny. I'm not in the Barbie movie. I don't know. I have no idea where that came from.
Oh, my God.
But people keep asking me. I should probably go in and remove it, because until people started asking me, I didn't know they were making a Barbie movie, let alone that I was supposed to be in it. So no, I'm not in the Barbie movie.
This has become a recurring joke on the show, how it keeps happening to me, Curtis. The only time I ever really felt bad about it, you're taking it in good humor. The pro wrestler Jacques Rougeau, I think, was branching out into acting a little bit, and they had it that he was going to have a part in a bigger movie, I think, with Ashley Judd, and I asked him about it, and he was kind of like, "No, I think somebody's making fun of me by hacking my page." And I felt like dirt for asking him about that, so I
appreciate... Well, in general, you know, my daughter is in college now, and one of the things that I think even from high school, she was told by her teachers and later her professors that Wikipedia sources are unacceptable and will not be accepted under any condition. And I think that that's a wise thing in general for people.
Generally so.
If you need some, the last time I looked at my Wikipedia page, it was so filled with mistakes. And it has, you know, I didn't put them there. Someone else did. But I don't know where they get their information.
Well, it's just funny that you're right. They have a failure rate of whatever degree. My failure rate with Wikipedia is well above what the average is, because seemingly every time I ask somebody about something from there, it's not accurate. It was, of course, in the service of, trying to do what we like to do on this show, which is to help guests promote whatever projects are going on. So we can scratch Barbie off the list. But as far as you've got the book going on here, are there any other projects out there that you'd like to talk about, Curtis?
Well, this summer has been really just the book tour. I haven't been doing anything else. I'm expecting I've got one more stop on the book tour, which will be at the beginning of November in Tucson, actually, returning to the University of Arizona. We're going to be doing a screening of Revenge of the Nerds, and I'll be reading from the book and signing and doing all of that sort of thing. We'll be selling the book there. So I've been doing that really since April, and I expect once I get through the end of this book tour, then I'll start thinking about going back to my day job.
Well, that appearance out there in Arizona sounds like it is going to be a singularly great one for your fans to both get to see a very entertaining movie with you there, have you read from the book, As we've been saying, an excellent book, Revenge of the Nerd, or The Singular Adventures of the Man Who Would Be Booger, by Curtis Armstrong. Curtis, again, amazing memoirs. Very grateful that your publishing house sent us out a copy here, and it was great to tear through that, have this conversation with you today. Best of luck on selling these books and the subsequent career. Please don't be a stranger. It's a pleasure talking to you, sir.
Well, thank you very much. It was great talking to you again.
I appreciate it, Curtis. Thank you so much. Thank you, everybody, for joining us here today in the FDH Lounge.
As we bring the show to a close, we would like to extend our deepest gratitude to NBC, CBS, ABC, Fox, all Clear Channel affiliates, TNT, TBS, USA, UPN, Deadspin.com, YouTube.com, YTMND.com, MySpace.com, various blogs, Fox News, CNN, CNBC, MSNBC, IamBored.com, Billboard.com, Google.com, ESPN, ESPN2, ESPN News, ESPN Classic, NBA TV, NFL Network, Sports Time Ohio, Athlon Magazine, Comedy Central, Cartoon Network, The Boomerang Channel, QVC, BET, The Spice Channel, Steno Notebooks, Manwich, Papermate Office Supplies, Waitresses, Strippers, Bartenders, Garbage Men, Janitors, Microwave Popcorn, The Writers of The Office, Scrubs, Entourage, My Name is Earl, Oz, Metalocalypse and the Boondocks, Awkwafina, and The Periodic Table of Elements.